Hello and welcome. My name is Dr. Monica Peek. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and to thank you for joining us for today's CME briefcase entitled Advancing Health Equity Across the Spectrum, Optimizing Biomarker Usage in Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Johnson & Johnson. So my name is Dr. Monica Peek, and I'm the Ellen H. Block Professor of Health Justice. I'm also the Vice Chair for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the Department of Medicine at the University of Chicago. And I've been a primary care physician for more than 20 years, screening for various types of cancer and walking patients through their journey when they get diagnosed with cancer. And so I'm really thrilled to be joined today by one of my colleagues, who is an esteemed colleague, Dr. N.J. Flores, as we talk today about a very important issue that affects many of our patients. Dr. Flores, or Dr. N.J., would you introduce yourself?
Yeah, is it my pleasure to be here, Dr. Peek, Monica. So I'm the Associate Director of the Cancer Care Access Program, also the co-director of the John Lang Cancer Program at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and associate editor for JAMA Oncology. I think this subject is extremely important, not only for young patients, but for all patients, because the diagnosis of lung cancer doesn't stop histologic subtype. Biomarker testing is essential.
Absolutely. So I'm super excited about the topic today.
So let's talk about what a biomarker is and the different types of biomarkers. So a biomarker, I want our audience and learners to see it as the fingerprint of the tumor. That's what allows to understand the tumor at a deeper phase, a deeper level. So when you have a diagnosis of lung cancer, in this case, we're talking about non-small cell lung cancer, we first have the histologic type. Is it a squamous or non-squamous? And from the non-squamous, then they get classified adenocarcinoma, large cell, and other subtypes. And even adenocarcinomas have other subgroups that can be papillary, they can be mucinous. But that is a way to see the tissue to stains. Biomarkers can help us understand what precipitated the cancer in case of patients with driver mutations, what other risk factors the patient may carry to their family, or they carry for other malignancies. Those are germline biomarkers or testing or results. And then we have the ones that will help us guide treatment. Today, we're going to focus on the ones that will help us understand the tumor and guide treatment. We're not going to be talking about germline testing. We're going to talk about somatic mutations or biomarkers that are acquired and they're seen in the tumor more than the DNA structure of the patient, himself, herself, or non-binary. So we define what a biomarker is. It's that fingerprint of the tumor. And their biomarkers are prognostic and predictive. And this is very tricky, right? Because even in some cases, we have biomarkers that are both. But prognostic indicates a patient's survival that is independent of the treatment received, because the biomarker is an indicator of the innate tumor behavior. And we're going to talk about a few examples of one versus the other. Predictive, this indicates therapeutic efficacy, because there's an interaction between this biomarker and the type of therapy and the patient's outcome. So prognostic is what is characteristic of the tumor, and predicted is what do I need to select treatment that will help me understand how the patient's tumor will behave. And before we dive deeper on this, we need to understand that this happens to patients. The patients are not defined by their disease. So avoiding defining patients by the biomarker testing and defining by that, but still remembering that how important it is. So we talk about the fingerprint, and that is the base of personalized cancer care. When you're getting married, and I'm mentioning this, Monica, because I'm getting married in 2 months. So
congratulations.
I need a reference in there. So when you're getting married, you don't want to buy your wedding gown or wedding tuxedo, all the clothes that you prefer, from the rack and just walk down the aisle, right? We all want the tailored dress that we send to the modiste to address to the way we like. And that's biomarker testing, in which we're able to tailor the care and we're able to tailor the testing, subsequent testing, and also the therapies. And I haven't had yet a lot of resistance with that. Everybody likes tailored outfits. So that has been good. It's also a good analogy of the key to the lock. So the key is biomarker testing. You will understand what the patient needs to open that lock, which is the lung cancer.
Those are excellent analogies. So the bottom line is that these biomarkers are really critical in determining the best treatment that's tailored to patient care. Should providers wait for these results to determine a treatment plan? And how does health equity play a role in all of this? Because I imagine that some of these might be very expensive, some of them may not be covered yet. How would a primary care physician like myself go about sort of thinking about biomarkers?
I think I'm going to use what we have learned over the decades for breast cancer so we understand. We no longer say breast cancer. We say hormonal receptor positive, hormonal receptor negative, HER2. The diagnosis of breast cancer is never complete unless you have hormonal status. And that's how we see lung cancer. We should see it like that. However, like you mentioned, Monica, health equity has a role here. Unfortunately, populations that live in rural areas, populations of color, and outside of the US borders, they have limited access to biomarker testing. And we're going to talk a little bit more that in detail as our conversation continues. But there is significant disparities, unfortunately, for biomarker testing. We're doing better than 10 years ago, but there's still disparities. And I think everybody should wait for biomarker testing because there are therapies that are not effective in certain types of lung cancer. So you don't want to put a patient in an effect therapy that's not effective. And also, if the patient gets put in the wrong therapy, may also interact with the subsequent therapy. So it's not only about choosing treatment, but also avoiding unnecessary toxicity. Like I told my patients, none of my drugs do not come with fatigue. They all come with fatigue. They all come with some kind of lab abnormality. Unfortunately, we don't have the first cancer drug yet that doesn't have a side effects. So biomarker testing allows to pick the best treatment to reduce the risk of unnecessary side effects. And many of these side effects are long-lasting. So, yes, it's like hurry up and wait. You get diagnosed with lung cancer, and now your doctor is telling you you have to wait 2 to 3 weeks for the results. But it's worth it because there's a difference between taking a pill once a day or getting full-on chemotherapy. So, very different quality of life.
One question I have is, are for places that are out very rural areas, can they send specimens to tertiary and quaternary medical centers for testing? Is that something that's possible?
100%. And there are two things. Let's break this down. So for remote areas or small practices, right? I'm in an ivory tower at Dana-Farber and Harvard, of course. So I understand. I used to work in the Midwest. I used to be at Mayo. So I had a firsthand experience of what is to be, there is nothing for 200 miles around you. So there are institutions that do external testing for one of them very well known is the Mayo Clinic where I train. So samples can be sent there. And there are a lot of commercial platforms that are available all across the country that small, medium practices can get samples to for testing. And there are many things that can be done now. There's also mobile phlebotomy for liquid biopsies. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But mobile phlebotomies, they come to the patient's house to draw the blood for liquid biopsies or cell-free DNA or ctDNA. So we have the pandemic had many challenges, but also many opportunities. And one of them was to be able to do this biomarker testing with liquid biopsy at the patient's home.
Excellent.
Yeah, we didn't know we could do it until, like always in medicine, something needs to happen, so we pivot.
Right. Emergencies sort of create ingenuity. So let's think about this in terms of a patient case. We've just talked about how important biomarker testing is to guide clinicians in precision medicine. So can you present Mrs. B to us today and how we can think about providers integrating guidelines into her care?
Yes. And before we go to this case, just quickly, there's many, many targets in lung cancer. There's not only one or two, there's many. And they continue to evolve. Only this year, we have two new targets. So every year, this list is becoming longer and longer to a point that approximately 55% of patients with non-small cell, particularly non-squamous, have a target mutation. So I
Wow.
want our audience to know that is no fishing, because I often hear that, oh, I'm fishing for biomarkers. No, dear, it's 55% oadenocarcinomas. You're most likely to find a biomarker that you're not. So we need to eliminate that perception that it's like, oh, I'm fishing. No, you're fish. You're not fishing. You're actually catching the fish with your hand. So let's talk about Mrs. B. Mrs. B is a 77-year-old female with a new diagnosis of advanced metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. She had a previous tobacco use. Unfortunately, she had a decline in her performance status that is related to the progressing newly diagnosed cancer. Given her age, she proceeds directly to empiric chemotherapy and supportive care. Let's break this down a little bit, Monica. What do you think?
Yes.
First, we need to understand that when we address performance status, we need to take into account the cancer, right? So that's a modifiable aspect. When we evaluate performance status, we really need to see the patient before the cancer and what are some of the changes that the cancer has made to the patient that could be reversible with therapy, right? One, a lot of patients can have very rapid responses if they have a mutation, so biomarker testing quickly. And one thing that I struggle with this, Monica, is empiric chemotherapy. And I'm going to be very honest, this is no Dr. House. There is no empiric chemotherapy. I don't like that term because there's so many side effects. And after you do chemotherapy, it has been proven over and over again that the adverse events of chemotherapy stick around. I have patients with neuropathy 4 years after the last dose.
So do I.
So this decision shouldn't be taken lightly. It's neuropathy, right? So empiric chemotherapy, supportive care, always and forever. But empiric chemotherapy, this is not Dr. House. We need to find that fingerprint. All right. So, what is the consensus? Who should get tested? Every non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer with a stage 1B to a stage 4 should get tested. And I'm going to simplify that. 1B to 4 non-squamous should get tested. If you have any doubt, you test. That's the answer. If you don't know, test.
Test.
Nobody will judge you for testing. And this is an NCCN, ASCO, all the guidelines have this. And it has been more broad now because these biomarkers are also affecting therapy in early stage. This is no longer stage 4. We have approved targeted therapy for EGFR early stage, ALK, RET coming up, new trials. So stage 1B to a stage 4. And I do recommend broad molecular profiling. So what is broad molecular profiling? That's full next gene sequencing instead of trying to do gene by gene. Why gene by gene is not a good idea? One, you're gonna forget a gene. Clinic is so busy. I was just having a meeting with my dean and I was like, you need to remind me because I'm in clinic. Right? It's like a different time when you're in clinic, you're so busy. So it can be hard to remember. And we just talk about how the two biomarkers have been approved in the last year. So for the general practitioner that sees melanoma, lymphoma, benign heme, can be very hard to catch up. Lung cancer is moving too fast. And I only see lung cancer. And I have a podcast about lung cancer. So next gene sequencing makes sure you don't have to remember. Second, it's more cost effective. If we're worried about the financial toxicity with biomarker testing, next gene sequencing is actually cheaper down the long run than doing gene by gene.
Yes.
And third, Monica, is tissue, because in lung cancer, tissue is still the issue. Our biopsies are not as easy as a breast biopsy or a colonoscopy. It usually includes some type of intubation, high pressure environment for doing these biopsies. So you want to preserve as much tissue as you want, and NGS or next gene sequencing allows you to do that. And finally, I do like NGS because it lets me know what other baggage the patient's tumor may have. And what do I mean by other baggage? We have the biomarkers that helps us direct therapy. However, new data is showing like biomarkers like STK11 and KEAP1 provide resistance to immunotherapy. So those patients need dual immunotherapy. So it's not only about selecting the drug, it's just understanding mechanisms of resistance. For example, for patients that are EGFR that have RB1 and TP53 mutation at diagnosis, they are 40 times more likely to transform down their journey, to transform to a small cell. And this incidence is going up because we're developing better drugs. So NGS helps me understand the baggage. This is what I told my patients. And here I am, Monica, again with my analogies.
Yes.
When you go on a date, you want to know what the baggage of that person is coming, right? You want to know if they have been previously married, do they have children, you know, what is going on, right? So we want to know as much as you can before you go on that first date. And that first date is the first line therapy. And that's what is so important because 30% of patients with lung cancer do not make it to second line. So picking the first time treatment, it may be more important than picking your first husband. But I'm not going to get into that. A little controversial. So moving forward, what can we do to optimize testing? I think it's very important to have a uniform pathway in the institutions that we do guideline concordant testing and trying to like, instead of having a million pathway, that leads to gaps in treatment and that leads to health disparities. When we have institutional uniform pathways, allows the patients all get the same testing. I think updating the staff about new biomarkers and new therapies is very important, right? So we are in August and we have four approvals, two new biomarkers, and it's only August, and that's a change of administration. So things can be very fast in lung cancer. So it's very important that we stay updated. In addition to that, it's very good to learn from mistakes and learn from barriers. If your patient have a very long wait for biomarker testing, it's very important to come back together as a team and say, what happened? Wasn't enough tissue? Do we only get FNAs? Did the sample didn't get sent to the right place? So it's always good to make sure that we as teams are accountable because biomarker testing is cancer care. So we want to make sure. And open communication. I have to tell you, Monica, I speak to my surgeons more than I speak to my mom. Today, I already spoke to two surgeons. So it's very important that we communicate. Dana-Farber, we have a live tracking all the biomarker testing. Also to avoid me emailing them every time. It's like, where is my tissue? Where is the biomarker testing? So there's a few tips on how to optimize biomarker testing.
Excellent, excellent. This is such good information. Because this information is coming out so rapidly. It's hard for an oncologist to keep up. And then for me as a primary care physician, there's no way. And so to have this kind of update is really valuable. And so one of the things that you had just mentioned is that there's a lot of testing that may be underutilized just because we may not be able to keep up with the information and to try and have some way of institutionalizing these pathways. So, NJ, can you share with our audience some of the data around underutilization so we can sort of get a picture of where we are in this country?
Well, I'm happy to. And before I break down the data, I want to be clear that most of the data is only about ALK, EGFR, and PD-L1. And that's only a small percentage
Yes.
of the biomarkers. So, in
That
this
other slide you showed
national.
had, this wheel of millions of biomarkers. It was a lot.
Yes, it is. It is a whole. It's 55%. And they all have weird names and weird letters. I remember being a fellow and say, like, how am I going to remember all of this? And I was a fellow. So,
Yes.
and then at that time, Monica, not to date myself, there was only four of them. and this national electronic health records database of over 17,000 patients Only 67% of all patients and 77% of patients with non-squamous had ALK, EGFR, and PD-L1 tested within 90 days of diagnosis. So
Wow.
77% should have been 100. And I
Right.
strongly believe that if we add the other biomarkers, that number will be lower than 77.
Absolutely.
And lower rates were associated with locally advanced, so stage 3B and C, particularly patients that have a squamous histology and patients that were Black or African American. And something important about this data, Monica, is that the database did not have ethnicity. So potentially Hispanics and Latinx were also not appropriately tested, because as we know, there's many issues with data when it comes to ethnicity.
Yes.
Furthermore, MILON, which is a study of nearly 1,000 patients in community practices, showed that 64% of patients with early stage and 83% of patients with metastatic lung cancer had at least one biomarker. We're talking about one, right? And we're talking now they're like 11 now. So, of which 36% and 17% had no testing. So that's like Mrs. B and better chemotherapy. No. That's so 2009. And 30% of patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer had results for at least nine biomarkers. So less than 50% have nine biomarkers, which is probably ideal. And only 37% of early stage and 57% have that next gene sequencing that we just talked about it. That is very beneficial. So you're probably wondering, that's like homegrown, right? This is in the US. Is it worse globally? Surprise it is. So I'm very proud to be a member of ISLC and a new board member. In 2024, we conducted the second ISLC global survey of biomarkers, and it's over 1,600 respondents in 90 countries. So this survey is to doctors and providers. And 98% believe that biomarker testing significantly impacted outcomes. So people know of it, though only 63% and 29% rank a highly important in late and early stage. And this is important because we have worked for the last, I would say, 15 years to improve testing in metastatic disease. Still 64% at best. And for early stage, it's even more challenging. And unfortunately, biomarker testing is not accessible in many low to middle income countries. So a lot of the guidelines that we're working in is better to test in tissue than get genomic testing. So what is this? We have certain biomarkers that can be tested with IHC versus PCR or next gene sequencing. In limited resource settings, I was just in Colombia and I told them, it's better to have an IHC that had nothing. So don't undermine the value of IHC or immunohistochemistry compared to having nothing. So we can do IHC for ALK, ROS1, for HER2, for example. And those tend to be cheaper compared to next gene sequencing when they may not be available. So, like my grandma used to say, I don't know about your grandma, but I was raised by a Latina grandma. And my grandma always told me, there is always a way around. There is always a way around. And that has been very helpful for a career in academia because there's always a way around.
Yeah, these numbers are stunning. We've got so far to go, so far to go. But you're right. Like, we cannot let the current status quo keep us, paralyzed. We have to continue to move forward. We have to think about your grandma's words and figure out a way around. Let's go back to our patient, Mrs. B, and who's 77 and considered older. What do we know about treating older patients with non-small cell lung cancer, and particularly in the setting of this new information that we have to learn about tailoring medication and therapies for people?
So over 50% of patients that are newly diagnosed with non-small cell lung cancer are older than 70 years, and 50% are older than 80. And these numbers are only expected to get higher in some departments, lower in some others, But for example, today I had a patient that the lung cancer is the third cancer she had. So she survived breast cancer, she survived ovarian cancer, and now we have lung cancer, right? So we are getting good with therapy. So our population is aging. This is not 1930 in which people were dying of tuberculosis. So our population is aging. And it's more important to know that a lot of older patients were not included in clinical trials. And I have a publication from 2017. I always talk about this publication as my number one, my first one hit wonder, if you saw. It was the first publication I was a fellow that got on national attention, and which she showed that the majority of the patients that are going into lung cancer clinical trials are men and fit and young. And that is not what walks in my clinic. That is
No.
not the reality. And all of
No.
them follow all the policies. So there is no, what I always tell my patient, there was no transportation issues in the trial. So patients that are geriatric have risk for certain organ damage. Because, like I told my patients, age is a number, but we cannot forget that your bone marrow is 75 years old. We cannot forget that your kidney is 75 years old. And they're also very likely to have polypharmacy, which is very common, unfortunately.
Yes.
And it was, actually, that was my thesis for medical school, the polypharmacy in the older adults.
Yes, these
However,
are my bread and butter of the patients that I treat. They have hypertension, they've got diabetes, they've got dyslipidemia, they have all of these problems, and then they get cancer on top of that.
yeah, and on top of that, you add the supplements that we don't know how they interact.
Right.
Is there, but it's part of our culture. My family are all physicians, but my grandma was a grandma before she was, she was always grandma first, physician later. And, it's also part of culture. However, with this may sound repetitive, chronologic age is just a number. I have patients that are less than 50 that have a very limited performance status. And I have a fabulous 85-year-old right now. Monica, she's fabulous. I don't have
Yes.
any other word to describe this woman but fabulous. And everybody was aware, afraid. And I sent her to the geriatrician because I do geriatric assessments in my patients, particularly early stage. I don't want to send a patient to surgery and then we have complications, to assess the patient holistically because the age doesn't matter. And this fabulous 85-year-old, she cruised through chemoimmunotherapy. She went to surgery. And after I met her, she had a complete response. She had a margarita that day because she didn't need more treatment. I told you, she's fabulous. So age is just a number. And it's not something that we say to make ourselves feel better. It's because holistic assessment of patients is what actually will determine the next step. I have a 32-year-old that cancer has done awful things to her. And I have this fabulous 85-year-old that would give anybody a run for their money. So assessment of patients holistically is what is the right thing to do for all patients. And one of the important things about targeted therapy and biomarkers is that biomarker testing allows us to give patients more tolerable therapies. It's very different to be taking a pill once a day than getting chemo that you will lose your hair. We do know that platinum-based therapy tends to be more toxic in patients that are age 70 to 79, even the ones that have good performance status. So it's higher risk of death, hematologic complications. We talk about the bone marrow, renal complications, and neurologic complications. And Monica, as a primary care doctor, you probably have seen this. We have these patients that are 70, 79 years old, and they have been doing well. But as soon as you take them out of the environment because of new lung cancer, all of these neurologic deficits that we're not aware to the patient, the family, the spouse. Just a little thing tips that over. So that's what targeted therapies are better tolerated than chemotherapy and also better quality of life. They also have less interactions. And immunotherapy. There's actually a study done by the FDA that was presented in ASCO 2023 that showed that patients that have high PD-L1 biomarker, so meaning higher than 50%, and even patients higher than 90%, older patients, older than 75, they have better outcomes than if you give them chemo plus immunotherapy. So that biomarker makes the difference. Oh, I infusion every 6 weeks, or I infusion every 3 weeks without the risk of renal damage. So Biomarkers are so essential for the treatment of geriatric patients. It shouldn't be only for young patients. Everybody deserves biomarker testing. And one of the things, Monica, that we need to take into account is a lot of geriatric patients may have a past medical history of tobacco use.
Yes.
Tobacco incidence significantly increased, and then we saw a drop. That the patient has a previous tobacco use history should not be a contraindication for biomarker testing. We have biomarkers that are associated with tobacco use that had pills like BRAF, MET exon 14, KRAS G12C, which is actually the most common biomarker of them all. So smoking history should not be exclusion criteria. And if it's the opposite, I think we should look for biomarker testing in the older population so we can have better options for them. And I think a special attention should be taken into account, not only about biomarker testing, but the side effects of chemotherapy are no joke.
Yes. This is super interesting, just how, the history of smoking, the age, how all of these things can change with this additional information that we can get with biomarkers. So what are our key takeaway messages from our first case?
I think the key takeaways is that age should not determine the choice for biomarker and also no performance status either. I have seen many times how appropriate biomarker testing have helped patients improve to a point that they're not who they used to be with their cancer diagnosis prior to starting therapy, within 6 weeks. So this is the magic of biomarker because you're able to find a therapy that provides responses that we never have seen before. I have a patient just a few weeks ago, ALK positive, older patient, and I started it in targeted therapy. And in 6 weeks, Monica, the patient came without oxygen, without wheelchair, no cane. And he was back to like hitting the balls in the driving range.
Oh my
So
goodness.
that's the difference. I never have seen that go chemotherapy. Somebody who goes chemotherapy and 6 weeks later comes like, I feel great. Barely anybody.
It's like a miracle.
Yeah, so that's the key, is the importance. And sometimes, just had to bring this to your attention, we don't have enough tissue. And I often get asked by oncologists in the community, should I go for more tissue? And like, the answer is always yes. Because you may have enough tissue for DNA biomarkers, and you may run out of tissue for RNA biomarkers. And the irony of that is that DNA biomarkers are always wrong first. The best therapies are actually the RNA biomarkers. ALK, NTRK, ROS1 had the best overall survival, the best outcomes. So yes, the answer is always go and get more tissue, if possible.
Excellent. Okay, so this was super helpful in learning just all of this, but also thinking about the impact of basically age bias, and thinking about who might qualify for some of the treatments and therapies for lung cancer, for non-small cell lung cancer, and the critical role for education and, of patient, of providers as well as patients, and engaging all members of the treatment team. I want to shift our conversation a little bit to thinking about other kinds of biases that we may have, and other social drivers of health that may impact who gets care, how they get care, et cetera. So, can you talk a little bit more broadly about social drivers of health and how that may impact lung cancer treatment?
I think social drivers of health as important as biomarker testing. I think they're both linked because where you play, where you work, and where you live influence your entire experience. We just did a large study in which we interview African American patients with lung cancer, and their commute to the cancer center affected their treatment choices, their participation in clinical trials. So as important as the history of hypertension and diabetes is, what is your health literacy? How far are you from me? What is issues with the insurance? Who cares for you at home? Who do you have to care for at home? Because many of our patients are also caregivers. All of that affects the cancer continuum And it's directly related to biomarker testing because we
Okay.
know that patients that are in low settings, like low income settings or limited resource settings, they're less likely to have biomarker testing. So where we live, where we grow up, work, where we play is as important as the biomarkers. Because how does it matter that you have a PD-L1 of 100% if you don't have a way to get to the cancer center for the infusion, right?
Right. All
That's
of
what
the
I ask all my patients the questions.
infrastructure that is available to those who have the financial resources and who don't have the responsibility that comes for with for those who have limited resources. So, can you talk a little bit just about the actual association between some of these social drivers and the prevalence of lung cancer itself?
The lung cancer is one of the cancers that's directly associated with poverty. So I'm going to use the Appalachian area as a great example. So the Appalachian area in the United States has one of the highest incidence of lung cancer, but also has one of the highest incidence of poverty, limited resources. Many of the towns are miners' towns. So
Exactly.
it tends to be a lot of generational behaviors. My father smoked, I smoke. And in many of these jobs, the only break that many of these employees have is when they go for a cigarette. So that whole driver in the Appalachian area is learned behaviors, limited resources, limited health care, and limited job opportunities that actually drives the patients to increase tobacco use. And we also know that for non-smokers or non-tobacco users, radon is our number one risk factor. And what happens with radon? So people that live in subsidized housing, there is no real, in many states of the United States, we did a study at the University of Wisconsin, well, in Wisconsin as a general, there is no real rules for Section 8 housing about radon testing. So many of these properties may have never been tested for radon, or they were tested when Reagan was president, and they never have been tested again. So that is linked to property and thus linked to lung cancer for tobacco users and non-tobacco users.
Yes. So many of the toxins and things in our water and our air and our earth are disproportionately burdened on poor populations. And so there are many environmental linkages between cancer and poverty, so that this is being a great example of people in Appalachia. So I want to have us translate this into another patient case. So, NJ, can you talk about our next patient?
So, of course, we have Mr. L, who's a 60-year-old African American man with newly metastatic non-squamous cell, non-small cell lung cancer. He receives disability income and has Medicaid or state insurance. Due to the cost of travel constraints and likely limited reimbursement for testing, single gene testing for EGFR, ALK, ROS is performed. Testing results are negative and immunotherapy is started. The issues I have with this, I just want to break it down. First, you use a lot of money. We're talking about constraints, right? To do EGFR, ALK, and ROS, but no PD-L1. So biomarker testing didn't really guide it, the PD-L1. And in some patients, if the PD-L1, which is a biomarker, is not high enough, immunotherapy is not enough. They need chemo plus immunotherapy.
So already you're seeing all kinds of things that are wrong with his care. And one of my questions was, so my official question is, how are these social drivers and biomarker testings, playing a role for this patient care? But can you talk about insurance coverage for biomarker testing? Does it cover some, none? Like, what do we know about that?
Well, I think unfortunately, insurance coverage has become so complex that it's very hard to make a blanket statement. Even the same company, even the same patient, the same, I have the pleasure and the challenge of treating family members, both diagnosed with lung cancer, and both in the same health plan, but one was the policy holder and the one was the dependent. And I was like, the coverage should be the same. No, it wasn't. And I was like, so it has become so complex, and they're putting so many obstacles to providers to get things approved. I do think it's like, let's put as many obstacles until the doctor gives up on this, right? But like I told my patients, I'm not pushy, I'm persistent. So I think it is mandatory for most insurance to cover. They may request a peer-to-peer, or they may request some required, but a lot of insurance need to follow the NCCN guidelines. And it was what clears in the guidelines is that for stage four non-squamous, patients need to get biomarker testing. What is tricky here, Monica, is which biomarker testing, right? This patient only had three. Do you fill the criteria? No. But in theory, the insurance cover biomarker testing, right? So it should be mandatory. I think their challenges are placed to the providers. And sometimes patients get these bills after you get the biomarker testing, and they're like $5,000, $6,000.
Oh,
And
my.
it takes a heal afterwards to get a cover or some way. But like I told my patients, do not pay anything until they tell us you have to. Because a lot of patients with cancer, this is something very unique that I want our learners to know. They feel they need to pay because that's what they have to do. And I think it's very unfair. They're dealing with a lot. A lot of them pay, sometimes tell me, but over time we have, talked to patients to say, you tell me. You tell me if something comes, send me a picture in the patient gateway or whatever the letter is. Because some of these letters are very scary.
Yes. And I imagine that particularly for families with limited resources, they're imagining that I have cancer. I may not survive this. Let me try and pay these bills so that I don't have to pass them on to my kids.
That is so true. There is nothing more noble than a patient with cancer. And if you're a woman and a woman of color with cancer, everybody's priorities are on top. It is important that we teach patients that, like my grandma said, just going back, there's always a way around.
That's right. That's so important, that people have this kind of advocacy, because, so many people are hounded by bill collectors and medical debt, and to have someone who is in the healthcare system saying, ignore that, because we're going to fight that. You worry about your care. We're going to push for this. To help to prioritize and to let them know that it's okay. I think that is hugely important.
Yeah.
Thank
So
you for all that you
I
do.
think one thing before we move, Monica, I think health literacy is really related to biomarker testing. I think patients that have limited health literacy, I do not believe in putting the responsibility of biomarker testing on patients. Because
Absolutely.
a lot of the teaching is like, oh, you need to ask your doctor. No, it's your doctor's job to do that. We don't need a patient who just got diagnosed with cancer to have more to-do lists. In my opinion.
Do you want to go back to our case and Mr. L, or is there anything else you want to talk about before we come back to him?
I think we can come back to Mr. L. Our learners need to know what happened. So, due to implicit bias or unconscious bias, and false assumptions about limited access to expensive therapies, he may not be able to access target therapy drugs or clinical trials. He has significant delays in biomarker testing. And as we talk about it, he only had EGFR, ALK, and ROS, and then immunotherapy was started. However, later it was found that the patient had a HER2 positive tumor. And the issue with that is that the first line treatment was wrong, and the patients with HER2 disease tend to have a lot of progression in the CNS. And when they have disease progression, it can be catastrophic. Very unique type of lung cancer. So this patient, unfortunately, his life was cut short by the lack of biomarker testing. We have oral therapies for HER2 that was just approved 14 days ago. And we have IV therapy for HER2. Immunotherapy alone is not enough for these patients. Immunotherapy can be part of the regimen, but alone is not enough. So we cut this patient short. We shoot life short. It is unfair. We have done biomarker testing, and honestly, it's just bad medicine. Because beyond the altruistic goals of doing the right thing, it's about being the right doctor and
Right.
the provider. Is it is not only the doctor. I think everybody's involved in a patient's care. If he nursing, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, they're also part of the care. And sometimes it's just one voice that is needed. Like, oh, what about Mr. L? HER2 status. That's IHC, which is cheap.
Right.
So that is my summary for that case. Unfortunately, this story from Mr. L is not rare, Monica. It happens every day.
I can imagine. We look at the stats for health disparities, but each of those statistics is a story, and a story that we, if we heard about them, we can easily see how they would play out. And most of them are not, horrible, cases of whatever. They're like, oh yeah, these little things that just add up to be, something that can kill someone. So, which gets to our next point of having all eyes on the patient, of having, a team-based approach where multiple people are empowered to say, hey, what about that HER2 status? And social workers involved and the primary care physician, because a lot of patients will go see their oncologist and then come back to me and say, what do you think about this? And I'm like, I'm not the oncologist, but I'm the one they trust. And so having a team-based approach is just as important as we think about these social drivers, as we think about biomarker testing. So I've got to make sure that I'm, up to date, but also thinking about how we do team-based care. And so one of the most important things is not just our commitment to evidence-based practice, but our commitment to making sure that we are all on the same page as far as having clear channels of communication, that we're all committed to a collaborative approach and hearing each other, that we are all committed to not just us being a team, but us having a the patient at the center of that team, and that the patients and their family and their social support network is included in these decisions. And so, that is how we make this whole thing work, that we make sure that balls don't get dropped, that the patients don't fall through the cracks, that we adhere to guidelines of care, and that disparities don't continue to happen. No matter if someone's living in a rural area or that they have insurance that may, want to make us like do 7,000, paperwork faxes to get approved, working as a team can help with our best patient outcomes. And so we are almost out of time, but I'm going to, or maybe a little bit over time, I'm going to try and summarize what we've talked about with some SMART goals, and then I'm going to have you tell me what I've missed. And so SMART goals are those that are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. And so these are the major points that I want our audience to take away from our presentation today. So first is to implement reflex testing protocols, so that ensures that all eligible patients receive comprehensive biomarker panels, removing the need for patients to initiate them or providers to initiate them, one-off testing, that there's a whole comprehensive panel. Two, that we ensure that every patient who has non-small cell lung cancer is eligible for systemic therapy, who is eligible is not denied this comprehensive biomarker testing due to misconceptions or operational barriers or things about insurance. And then three, to promote a team-based approach to ensure that testing is performed early and the results are available to inform therapy choice. And so, NJ, is anything that I missed? Anything else that you want to add?
I don't think you missed anything. I think I would like to add that is tobacco use history and age should not be factors that we preclude biomarker testing.
Absolutely. All right. I want to remind our audience that this activity and a wide variety of activities and resources about non-small cell lung cancer are available on the CME Outfitters website. and that today's CMEO briefcase is just one of a series of activities that can be found on the Health Access and Social Responsibility Hub on the CME Outfitters website. And I hope that you'll check out the other activities in this series. All of them are fabulous. So to receive CME or CE credit for this activity, participants must complete the post-test and evaluation online. So please do that to receive your credit. You'll be able to download and then print your certificate immediately upon completion. So I'm Dr. Monica Peake. I want to thank you, our audience, for your continued commitment to ensuring that all patients receive the best care. Thank you, Dr. NJ Flores, for joining me today. It really has been a pleasure. I thank you for all that you do, for your patients, for all of the education that you continue to provide around the country, for joining us today, and just for being a beautiful human. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Peake, and thank you to the CME Outfitters to continue to talk about equity and access, because regardless of what happens, that is still a priority.
Great. Thank you so much. Have a great day, everyone.